This is the Education Gadfly Show.
And I was wrong.
Happens once in a while, Mike. Just once.
Oh, you're kind. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. You're at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. Now, please welcome my special guest for this week, John Winters. Professor Winters, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
John is an associate professor of economics at Iowa State University and the author of a brand new study just released by the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, What You Make Depends on Where You Live, College Earnings Across State and Metropolitan Areas. So great to have you on the show, John.
Happy to be here.
Also joining us as always, David Griffith. Welcome back.
Hey, Mike. To the show. Hey, good to be here.
All right. Great to have you on. All right. Well, as I indicated, this is one of these shameless self-promotion podcast episodes that we do. We have to talk about this great new study by Professor Winters that is out this week. And that is really packed full of fascinating information and so much to get into. So let's get with it on Ed Reform Update. So, John, you know, the genesis of this study, I think it was maybe a couple years ago, I was writing something about career tech and this question of whether we should be in the K-12 system encouraging all kids to go to college, especially a four-year college. I thought, well, let me make the point that, you know, surely we know there is this thing called a college earnings premium, where in general, on average, you get paid a lot more if you go to a four-year college than if you don't. But surely that varies across the country. I mean, it must play out differently in big cities than in small towns. And so let me make that point that, you know, maybe if you're in a small town somewhere, maybe you don't get as much bang for your buck by going 4 year. Maybe 2 year does just as well. And guess what? I could not find those data. They did not exist. I couldn't believe it. Nobody had looked at this before. And so we started digging, and the digging led us to you as somebody who knew something about this world of trying to look at returns to education. And we are so grateful that you agreed to work with us on this project. So tell us about the study, Professor Winters. First of all, what data did you have to use in order to try to compute the college earnings premium at the state level and at the metro level? What could you use for that purpose?
Sure. So the data set that I use is the American Community Survey. It's a representative sample of the U.S. It also has geographic identifiers and income information, education information.
Is that Census Department information?
Yes, it's administered and distributed by the U.S. Census Bureau.
Great. All right. Now, you had to make a bunch of decisions about how to look at this, such as, do you look at every worker, or, you know, but then that's strange if you include teenagers working summer jobs, that's kind of weird. How do you think about people who are nearing retirement? Maybe they're not working full time. What were some of those decisions you made in terms of exactly which people you included and did not include?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I think we wanted to do is, if we're going to be thinking about the college earnings premium, trying to compare, say, the earnings for a bachelor's degree holder to the earnings for a high school graduate, we want to try to make them comparable. But we also, in order to make this representative, we need to have a relatively large sample. So there is kind of this tension. Do we want to narrow down very specifically, or do we want to have broad groups? In the end, we decided to focus on full-time, four-year workers. So you don't necessarily want to compare, you know, people that work full-time and people that work part-time. So we focus on full-time, four-year workers. And then we also limited the sample to people who are ages 30 to 59. Those are kind of peak earning years. Mm-hmm. Also people who were born in the U.S. And obviously there's a lot of pros and cons to any sort of data choice you have, but try to make the sample comparable yet representative of, you know, a large cross-section of society.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're comparing across state lines and between different metro areas. And of course, what's tricky is that there's vastly different costs of living, but we didn't have to really look at that per se, because what we're looking at are not the raw salaries people are earning, but the comparisons, right, between, say, what a four-year college degree gets you on average versus a two-year or versus high school. So we can compare those premiums versus the dollars themselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing, you know, it's very difficult to actually measure the cost of living, in part because the cost of living depends on what people buy, and what I buy are probably different things. So what's the cost of living, you know, for you versus me? So obviously we have to take some sort of averages. And if we kind of assume that people have more or less similar consumption patterns, then to some extent, the areas that have high cost of living for one group also have this high cost of living for a different group. And so, for example, New York City is more expensive than Ames, Iowa for everybody. And so if we think about, maybe we could adjust the, you know, the incomes by 30% or 50% or whatever the cost of living differential is, Well, it adjusted that both for highly educated workers and for low educated workers, and it kind of nets out. So one of the nice things about the college earnings premium is that, you know, we're comparing, you know, really thinking about obviously these differences across areas, but comparing the mean earnings for one group of workers to the same group of workers or similar group of workers with different education level in the same area.
All right, so let's get to the findings. And I do remember when we first spoke way back when, you know, I thought we were going to find that, hey, there's might be some places where you get pretty much as much salary bump from a 2-year degree as a 4-year degree. You were much more skeptical about that. Turns out you were right. I was wrong. No surprise there. So look, the major finding is that a 4-year degree does give you a big bump pretty much everywhere, both compared to 2-year degrees and, of course, high school diplomas, but that there is still quite a bit of variation. What else did you find?
One thing in terms of the conventional wisdom, you know, a college degree is on average good. I think the conventional wisdom holds on average. But one of the things you mentioned we've talked about before is that there's a lot of heterogeneity around the averages. So what's true for, you know, the average person is not true for everyone. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of geographic variation. And so one of the things that kind of came across here when we're looking at some of these college earnings premiums is that workers in more rural areas or smaller MSAs, you know, the earnings premiums are smaller there. The earnings premium is actually much larger in these more urban states and these large metropolitan areas. And part of that has to do with just the return to skill is just higher in some of these large urban areas.
And I mean, big variation. I was looking at some of these numbers yesterday and got some places, some states where it's over 100% the difference between a college degree and a high school degree. You know, so you'd make twice as much by getting that college degree, you know, and there's other places where it's maybe half that much, depending on where you live. So still a good investment to go to college in most places. Again, you have to consider the cost of college and the loans and all that sort of thing, but it certainly seems to pay off more in some places rather than in others. You know, we make the point in our foreword that still does mean that when young people are deciding whether to go to higher education, whether to go for a 2-year degree, a 4-year degree, they should certainly think about what they want to be when they grow up, but they also should think about where they want to live. You know, and if you want to live in New York City or the Washington area, the Bay Area, or some of these other big metro areas, you know, you're really going to be at a huge disadvantage if you don't get that 4-year degree, somewhat less so in other parts of the country. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I guess, you know, part of the thing is extent we don't always know what we want to be or where we want to be when we're young. So that there's a little bit of difficulty there, but there are definitely people that can say with a pretty high confidence that, you know, they're going to stay where their family has lived for generations, obviously, or maybe they, you know, just have a natural preference for being in a smaller area. And so obviously they need to be part of the message, obviously, is to be well informed about, well, what are the earnings opportunities for various educational paths in those areas that you think you might want to live, and, you know, and try to make an informed decision. Not encourage anybody from getting education. Education is beneficial in itself, but big part of the, you know, the value of education is that, you know, you can get higher earning potential. And so you need to know as much as possible, well, what are the earning potential for various educational opportunities in the areas, the places they want to live?
Yeah. You know, one other finding that I found, well, fascinating, but also troubling, was that you looked at the findings by race. And I guess a few other studies have done this before at the national level. I think yours was the first one to be able to do it at the state level. But what you find is that there are big differences by race. Now, a lot of people would be like, well, duh, Mike, you know, hello, there is such a thing as racism. Yes. But the question is not just the fact that, for example, whites make more than African Americans at every education level, it's that the college wage premium for whites is dramatically higher than it is for African Americans. Right. In other words, and as you dig in, it's really that college educated whites are making much, much more money than college educated African Americans and Hispanics, whereas the differences where high school graduates are much smaller. You know, and then you can see how this varies across states. Some states that pattern holds, and other places it's closer to one another. So what is causing this? You know, is it true that somehow college educated African Americans face greater discrimination in the workplace than high school educated African Americans and Hispanics do?
You know, Mike, that's a great question. And obviously, I generally is uncertain about what's driving this, as I suspect you are. Certainly, racism is probably part of the story. There are probably some opportunities that are not available. They may differentially affect people across different education groups. Now, that said, you know, one of the things that's just worth pointing out is when you do look at the race-specific breakdown at the national level, Asian Americans are actually doing about, you know, as well in terms of bachelor's degree earning as whites. So, you know, that does think, well, what, you know, what are some of the maybe deeper understandings or explanations? There's been a lot of talk, and we don't get into this in this study. The study was already quite long, and we're limited by how much we can split the data. But, you know, there is this issue about opportunities in high-paying fields like STEM, finance, economics, medicine. So one of the, you know, arguments that we could make is a possibility for earnings for blacks and Hispanics are much lower than earnings for whites and Asians is that maybe they're selecting into college majors and career fields that are not as lucrative. And it's also possible that even when they do select into those career fields, that they're somehow disadvantaged either by racism or other challenges that are not experienced by other groups. So again, it's a great question. And yeah, certainly something I've tried to think about a lot more. And It warrants a lot more investigation, but I don't have a clear answer at this time.
David, you want to get in here? That tough one or anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just still probably struggling with, I guess, what the policy takeaway is here, right? Because I think we do want to be careful discouraging people from going to college when it seems to be a good move for so many of them. I was not on this report, so I haven't thought about it as long as you guys have. It was interesting to me that there seemed to be so little advantage to an associate's degree. In other words, as far as I could tell from the graphs I was looking at, there's almost no sheepskin effect there. There's like, might as well just go to a four-year college and drop out after 2 years. Is that an unfair way of characterizing the results? Or?
So one thing I'll say is that the type of associate degree we're not able to differentiate among in here. So the associate degree category includes people that have like an associate's of arts, for example, in like an academic field, an associate's of arts in English literature versus people that have an associate's of science in a more technical field. The CPS, which is a different survey administered by the Census Bureau and distributed by on behalf of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, does have some information there. It turns out if you look at just national averages, those are not that far apart. So like an associate's of arts versus an associate's of science are not that far apart. So overall, that thing is not necessarily a big difference, but there's still certainly, I guess I'd say, variation within that. So for example, in medical fields, an associate's degree, you know, can offer a higher mean earnings. And there's certainly plenty of fields in the associate's degrees that are not as lucrative. We also, in the report, we have a category called some college, but no degree. We, you know, intermittently talk about how to think about that. That is a very heterogeneous group that includes some people that started a four-year school, you know, maybe they attended 3.5 years and dropped out, but it also includes some people that have like a one-year certificate or a six-month certificate. And so that group is a very heterogeneous group. One of the things that kind of relates to your comment is it's actually kind of surprising that that group of some college is actually pretty similar to the associate. And again, I'd love to be able to unpack, well, what exactly do those people in the some college category, what exact education do they have? And the people in the associate's degree, what exact education do they have? Unfortunately, the data, really, we just don't have that right now. It would be great to have, you know, and again, I think hopefully we're moving in this direction to have better data, you know, a more precise assessment based on specific credentials that people might have.
No, and look, and to the policy question, David, you know, in my view, it's more of a local policy question. It's to say, how big a focus should there be in high schools around preparing students for post-secondary education that's not the four-year degree? You know, that's the one-year credential, that's the two-year technical degree, you know, basically career tech stuff where kids could get started in high school on those routes. And look, I think that the equation looks somewhat different. If you're in a small town or even a small metro area and you expect most of your students to stay close to home, you know, then I think there's a stronger argument that that should be a pretty big part of high school. If you're in Washington, D.C. and you expect your students to stay close, you know, look, maybe the message of, hey, everybody really needs to go for that four-year college degree if you're going to have any shot of getting a decent wage someday. You know, maybe that means that you don't focus quite as much on CTE.
John, let me ask another question that I'm sure you can't answer with the available data. So let's suppose I'm in a small town and I do want, you know, a four-year degree. I guess the question for me is, how many kids would benefit simply from moving to the city with the same degree, right? I mean, is the takeaway that you shouldn't get the degree or that you shouldn't stay in a small town? Sorry to be blunt, but right? I mean,
well, you can't make that decision for other people. Right?
I'm making a statement. I'm posing a provocative question, Mike.
Yes. All right.
Yeah. Yes. And it's a great question. And again, I think the answer varies, right? So one of the takeaways, again, of the report is there is no one size fits all or, you know, single answer for everyone. I mean, to be quite blunt, a lot of young people who live in, you know, less populous areas might and want to get education might be better served by thinking about moving off to the big city. But at the same time, you know, you can think, well, what does that mean in terms of the people left behind? National level, at the state level, at the individual level, there maybe are different optimal outcomes and optimal choices. So for the individual, what may be good for you, right, is leaving. That doesn't necessarily mean that local policymakers should push you out the door. You know, in some ways, try to encourage the ones that want to stay to succeed. And of course, the ones that want to leave are probably going to leave either way. And I don't necessarily think local policy should discourage that. Part of the idea is trying to make this information available to people and actually better information than what we have here so that they can make informed decisions. And again, 18, 19, 20-year-old young people don't always make the best decisions, but to the extent we can provide better information, hopefully unbiased information, you know, they can hopefully make better educational investments that benefit them and society more broadly.
All right. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. So much more to talk about perhaps another time. Professor John Winters from Iowa State's Economics Department, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, we just had a great chat with John Winters about our study, his study that he did for us about the college earnings premium. So as I said, you know, I had this bet that we were going to find lots of places where you did not get that much of a bump for a four-year degree versus a two-year degree. And I was wrong.
Happy once in a while, Mike. Just once.
Oh,
in a while.
You're kind. You are kind. What? I mean, obviously, we talked a lot about the variation and this puzzling and sobering findings around race. But were you surprised at all that the 4-year premium was so big, or to put it a different way, that the 2-year premium was so small?
No, I don't think I was surprised as you were, because, you know, it just seems when you really dig in, it's just not happening in a ton of places where we're seeing a big premium out of that, you know, the 2-year versus the 4-year. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like in the places where we do see that 2-year premium competing with the 4-year, it's fairly rare. And as you know, it's in these states that tend to, you know, heavily rely on natural resources and mining and all those sorts of things. So.
All right. Well, tell us, you have anything for us today that might be surprising or not surprising? What do you got for us?
I think it's going to not be surprising, but it's still very useful. It's a new NBR study. It examines the roles of teachers and schools in reporting cases of child abuse. So this is a pretty tough topic, obviously, but one I thought was relevant given that so many kids are now out of school due to the coronavirus. So they're looking at these cases. Statistics, this is just sort of background, show that around 13% of all children have a confirmed case of maltreatment, which is the term they're using, by age 18. And that's defined as failure to act on the part of a parent or caretaker, which results in death, serious physical or emotional harm, sexual abuse or exploitation, or acts that pose an imminent risk of serious harm to a child. Okay? So the study includes two separate regression discontinuity designs. And the first RD analysis uses data from about 35 states from 2003 through 2015 that provide data on child maltreatment or abuse to what's called the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data File. And basically, those are the referrals to Child Protective Services that are assessed to see if they merit further examination, and if they do, whether those referrals can be substantiated. So over that period, there were roughly 48 million reports of child maltreatment, and over 90% of those cases, the child's parent is the perpetrator. And the most common form of abuse is neglect followed by physical abuse. All right, so that's just heart-wrenching background in all this.
And Amber, just to be clear, I mean, it's awful, but 48 million, I mean, there's only 55 million kids in K-12 education. So I'm assuming many of these must be multiple reports for the same child.
Multiple reports, that's right. And keep in mind, this is from 2003 through 2015.
Ah, all right. Okay.
You know, it's a pattern over time. So they use statewide policies across states and over time regarding the earliest age at which a child is allowed to enter school. So they're testing whether the investigated reports of child abuse for 5-year-olds in particular is greater for children born just before the statewide school entry eligibility cutoff date. So they actually enroll, treatment kids enroll in kindergarten in the year that they turn five, relative to those born just after that eligibility cutoff date. So they're enrolling in the next year. So a child's exposure to educators varies during that child's fifth year of life based on being born on these adjacent days. Basically, I mean, we all know that these policies aren't followed to a T. So this is more like an intent to treat estimate. The key result is that they find an increase in reported instances of child abuse between 5.4 and 9.2%. And if we assume that this is all new reporting for a different child on each report, that means 0.3% of five-year-olds are being newly reported to Child Protective Services because of their kindergarten eligibility. And then they look at reporter type, so who's reporting the cases, and they show that school contact increases the number of first reports for a child, as well as additional reports that confirm prior cases of suspected abuse. So educators are both newly reporting cases and also reporting prior cases as well. And then their second discontinuity analysis uses variation in the school calendars. So they're looking at the end dates and start dates set by school districts to identify the effects, again, of exposure to a school setting on the same thing, on child abuse reporting. So the idea is similar to the first one. They're testing whether the number of reports is greater when children are attending school compared to the dates they're not attending school. And this time they use data from the 25 largest districts, pulling the start and end dates from 2005 through 2016. This time they include all kids from ages 6 to 17, not just age 5, like that earlier analysis. And so in a nutshell, because it's a long study, but in a nutshell, they find that reports go up between 48 and 64% at the start of the school year. They also peak 1 month before the school year ends, as if educators are aware that kids are about to, you know, go the summer without them around. And so they see a peak about a month before school ends, and then they see a sharp decrease when school actually ends. And they look again at the type of reports, and they find that educators are responsible for about 33 to 41% of reports. But this time, about half of the reports are from other people, social service, mental health professionals, and others, owing to the different ages of the kids. And for instance, more school counselors, perhaps at the high school campuses, and so on and so forth. So see greater variety in the types of folks reporting the abuse when they open up the ages. Analysts close by saying that teachers play a key role in reporting child abuse, and we should make sure that they receive proper training to identify it, since reporting is very uneven across the country and across school districts. So that's what I have.
Ooh, well, yeah. Sobering, and as you say, timely, because of course, for months now, every child in the country has been at home. And that means that if children are being abused, that is not being seen by their teachers and reported. And we do know that reports are way, way down right now, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we're all trying to figure this out, you know, what poses the greatest dangers to kids being in school, out of school, what kids are at greatest danger. And so, yeah, I mean, this just gives us another piece of information here.
Yeah. It's just so hard to quantify. I mean, you're ultimately weighing these against human lives, right? And you've got to come up with some sort of way of rationally doing a trade-off between these things. Nobody wants to say that, but that's the reality of what it means to adopt a policy. And keeping schools closed is implicitly making a choice for human life versus the sorts of things you just described, along with education and probably lots of other things we couldn't begin to describe. And going the other direction is, nobody wants to say it, but you're accepting a certain loss of life as the cost of doing business and going back to normal, like we do with virtually every government policy.
Well, you know, look, you know, David, you've been saying for weeks on our show that getting kids in school even once a week.
Yeah.
Zero.
And yeah.
For example, where that's the case, you know, that if the child's there at least once a week, the teacher's laying eyes on him or her, the principal is, and you know, might be able to tell if something's not going right in the home, and action can be taken. That's way better than going months and, you know, I mean, it's going to be 6 months in September when kids come back. For schools to say, well, we're just going to delay the start of the year and keep doing remote learning. Finding some way to have some interaction with kids, even in tiny groups and socially distant and all the rest, right, Amber? I mean, this is a strong argument for that to happen.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I'm sure you guys are even more familiar with the research. You keep up with it on, you know, I've seen some of these studies about child spreaders being sort of discredited. They're not really sure whether kids can be the super spreaders anymore, which was, you know, widely publicized. Obviously, we're thinking a lot about the adults and their health and welfare as well as the kids. But yeah, super hard to sort of, you know, I mean, the research around this is so on so many unknown variables still.
Amber, do you have a better sense than I do? I mean, I have one experience, which, believe it or not, happened on, it was the second day of school, actually, where I reported something that happened in the school parking lot. I don't know. I guess my question is, you know, what the channels are through which this gets reported, whether that struck me as dramatic at the time and potentially unusual. But I also know that kids often don't report these things or even have any context for it.
Yeah. And I think educators are a little nervous too about reporting it if they get it wrong. And what does it mean? Are they going to be, you know, what kind of legal responsibilities have they now opened themselves up to when they report it? And that's the kind of stuff that I think, you know, I don't know about you, David, but I was not given any of that information when I was a teacher. You know, what does it look like if you suspect child abuse? Who you should go to? What are the signs? I mean, that wouldn't have taken a lot of time, you know, just to kind of even give a pamphlet to teachers in their inbox. Just not transparently delivered in terms of what teachers should be looking for, and much less any kind of training on this.
Oh, whew, that is a tough topic, but an important one. Thank you, Amber. Appreciate it.
Yes,
that is all the time we've got, though. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.